The answer is subsistence. How do you get your kids to spend time in the natural world? Subsistence. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. This week we return to our theme of the last child in the woods. How do we get beyond the hand-wringing about this? Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, in Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422, email talk at APRN. What we'll find is there's a lot of steps between here and there beyond the hand-wringing. Today we'll hear about ground truth and campfire on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So you can kind of go back to this guy by the name of Ernest Thompson Seton. He was an artist, and he wrote a really famous book about a wolf by the name of Lobo. And it was really one of the first books that that looked at a wolf as something other than a creature that we should all be afraid of. Because he was an artist, I think, Mr. Seton had a fertile imagination. And one of the things that he did was inspire a whole generation of Americans to start looking at the natural world in a different way, to start looking at the outdoors as something that civilization didn't need to pull us away from. In fact, we needed to get back into the woods. And he thought, well, where else to look but to the indigenous people of the continent, the Indians. And so he published all this stuff about Indian crafts, and he made a lot of it up. For instance, building a teepee and putting a hole in the top where the smoke would come out. Well, smoke never did come out the way he designed his teepee, but nonetheless, it caused a craze among the young and among adults. And then the progressive movement came along, Teddy Roosevelt and all that sort of thing, and all of a sudden, they were wanting to bring back the buffalo, and they were wanting to create national parks in Alaska, and they began doing all that. And that was the progressive era. And here was this outfit called Campfire Club of America. And it was run by this William T. Hornaday. And Hornaday, like Seton, was one of these people who, he succeeded in bringing the bison back, he was not so interested in big game hunting and trophy hunting and things like that, and so he was more interested in preserving the habitat of the wildlife, and he figured very, very strong into the history of Alaska when you go back and look at the roots of all this. But at this club of his that he had, which was basically a lot of them were businessmen. I mean, influential people, Rotarians and Masonic Lodge members and people like that. And they would get together at this place that they built in the woods and camp. They would camp. They would rusticate. This is what they called it back then. They would rusticate. And it was on the front porch of the lodge of Mr. Hornaday's Campfire Club where the Boy Scouts of America was born. And in Vermont, there was a lady that said, well, you can't just do this for boys. You got to do it for girls, too. And so it turns out that this same Ernest Thompson Seton was involved with both the Boy Scouts and the Campfire Girls. And they were all born, really, in 1910. By 1912, they were in Alaska. Is that right, Barb Dubovich?
Hello there. Yes. Actually, around 1912 is where we can track back one of the first Campfire Girl clubs.
And this is just crazy. Barb Dubovich is your executive director, is that
right? I am. I'm
of Campfire USA.
Yes, Alaska Council.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the Campfire Girls anymore. It hasn't been for quite a while, right?
It has not, no. It's a co-ed organization, and we went co-ed in the 70s. And so now all of our programs serve both boys and girls in the state and nationally.
And you were telling me that actually the Alaska Council was an important part of going co-ed at all.
That shift, yeah. Back in, after the earthquake, our council went down to Seward and started providing programs in the summer for girls as their parents began to rebuild after the tsunami. And so it became clear that, you know, the boys were is as much need, if not more need, of a programming through the summer. And so as our rural Alaska program grew and we went into other communities throughout the state, we actually just started providing both boys and girls a program. And so in dialogue and with shifts in our national organization, we were advocates for having the organization become co-ed versus only Campfire Girls.
Well, you've got a darling shot that I ask you to bring in so it can we can show it on 360 North. I'm going to put it up right now. And this is Juneau, Alaska in what, 1914, I think?
1914, yeah. That's our earliest picture that we have in our archives of a Campfire Girls group. They're in their ceremonial garb, meaning that it's, you know, some special event, a ceremony. And you can see the beads that they've earned hung on their gowns. And they're in the out-of-doors. And so that's the only record we have. That's the earliest record. And it actually hangs in the Capitol as well. I found it in the Capitol Hall one day as I was down there in Juneau. So we're proud of that.
All right. At this point, I want to introduce our other guests. And I'll hold up their flyer, too, although it's from a couple of years ago. But nonetheless, they're still sending their documentary out around the festival circuit, or have been. And may show up on TV, who knows? Journey on the Wild Coast, and I'll hold that up. This is Ground Truth Trekking, and with a pair of young people who live in Seldovia, Alaska, and actually trekked, I mean, on land, like with a little boat, little raft, and their equipment, and carried everything all the way from down in Seattle to False Pass. And I'm talking about going through icy straits. I'm talking about doing the whole deal. So Aaron McKittrick and Hig Higman, one of you joining us by Skype from their yurt in Seldovia. Somebody, say hi.
Hello, this is Aaron.
And this is Hig. How's it going?
It's going really well. And I wanted to point out that you guys made this trip a little while ago, and one of the things that happened, Aaron, as I understand, is you got pregnant, and now you have two kids.
That's right. We have a two-year-old and a two-month-old.
Yeah, so the two-year-old made the last month of that journey in utero. And then this summer we spent a month up in the Arctic walking. Aaron had had Katmai, the two-year-old, on back and was five and by the end 6 months pregnant with Latuya, the now two-month-old. So,
yeah, we took the whole family down the Chukchi Sea coast for a month.
So this wasn't a one-time thing. This seems to be a way that you're approaching life with your feet, basically.
Yeah, well, you know, it's remarkable. You know, we're both scientists at their background, and you can read and study all sorts of things, but it's real different kind of learning. There's a lot of things that you never expect you needed to learn until you get out there and actually see places. So, we really value that, and we always, you know, despite the discomforts, we enjoy ourselves a lot.
Yeah, and at this point, I think we have about a 7,500 mile trekking habit, so it's kind of a hard thing to stop for now at this point.
Well, it is, and I guess it's a fundamental part of the relationship between the two of you, now the four of you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, I mean, it's something that, that's been sort of defining throughout Aaron and my relationship, and you know, right now the little ones, they don't have any choice, so they definitely come along on everything, but they're definitely also changing what kinds of experiences we have.
Well, I remember long ago, it was actually the father of Chris McCandless, who first said the words "ground truth" to me, and he was the guy. He was the engineer The head of the project that NASA sent up, the CSAT, which was the first active remote sensing satellite, had radar, altimeter, and all that sort of thing, synthetic aperture radar. And the thing flew, I don't know, a few orbits, and then it went down, and it was viewed as a failure and kind of laughed off. But he showed up at this scientific meeting, and he had just his endless amounts of imagery, and it was just absolutely exquisite. And he said, everybody thinks it's a failure, and here's all this imagery, and we proved that we could do it. I don't think it was a failure at all. And I said, well, what? I don't even know what I'm looking at. And he said, I don't either. We've got to ground truth it. Because here they were using this new technology, and they had no idea what they were looking at. And since then, of course, they have ground truthed a lot. And it turns out this is absolutely indispensable for operations in the ice. Synthetic aperture radar is the way to go now. So is this where you... Is this basically, I mean, do you people think about the space program? Where'd you get this title?
Well, you know, yeah, that's exactly the origin of the idea of ground truth. You know, you look at this, at satellite imagery or other remote sensing data, and there's all kinds of cool things you can find out. We spend a lot of time on Google Earth, and actually we were joking this summer, we had a little trip that was partly planned based on some Google Earth imagery, and we got out there and we started walking. We're like, oh man, this is even better than on Google Earth. but that's kind of the idea. You look at imagery, and there's a lot you can see there. It's an incredibly powerful way to see the world, to see it, you know, from afar and from space, that sort of thing. But the ground truth, when you're walking around on the ground, there are always a lot of surprises. Even if you think you have the perfect image and know exactly what's going on, there are often a lot of surprises when you're on the ground. And so that's the idea of ground truth.
And we have, for our own work, kind of expanded the concept. So instead of just looking at satellite data, we do a lot of research on things like big resource issues in the state, mine projects, that kind of thing. And some of the ground truth is actually, you know, talking to people who live in the area and things like that. So that's sort of an expanded concept from just actually pictures.
Yeah, maybe the remote sensing is, you know, a press release from a mining company, and then the ground truth is talking to mine workers and local residents on the ground. So it's more by analogy there, but the same concept.
Well, you know, basically, I think even experienced trekkers, you show them a map of where you guys went, and they would say, that's not possible. But and maybe even you guys thought, well, I'm not sure, you know, what we're going to be up against in some of these places. I mean, you couldn't have known a lot of these, and yet you just persisted and you did this, and for some reason you had this dream that you were going to do it, and then you just kept at it until you did it. And there's a metaphor for life in there, I think. But I want to turn particularly to the point that's in the documentary Journey on the Wild Coast, at which you stumble upon the scene of a reality television show where people are think that they're surviving. And your dietary reflection is absolutely priceless about that. Could you, one of you, just describe what that was?
Well, yeah, we were at Icy Bay, which this was in November, which it's not the time of year you expect to meet anyone in Icy Bay. And we walked in, we saw four-wheeler tracks on the beach, and we're pretty surprised by this. And turns out, yeah, this is reality TV show being filmed. And the thing that really struck us that you're referring to there is you know, it's the premise for this show. This is called The Alaska Experiment, put on by the Discovery Channel. The premise was that they were going to set these folks up. You know, we met, for instance, a nice couple from New York that they had a wall tent, and they had a lot of food and stuff, but the food wasn't meat. And they set up this idea that without meat protein in their diet, that they were just basically going to, you know, shrivel up and die or something. However, if you actually looked at the food they had, there was actually a fair amount of protein in there. And it's also not true that your body can actually go without protein for quite some time or with very minimal protein. And so the entire premise of the show revolved around this sort of flawed idea. And because everyone, you know, the film crew, the writers, and the participants all believed it, it drove the narrative in its way, but it was completely false.
But they did, but they believed it.
Yeah.
I think that they all believed it. I mean, that's the thing with the reality TV show is you don't get people who know what they're doing, because that wouldn't make a very good reality TV show. So, you know, the people, you know, the folks we met were pretty nice, but they were very inexperienced in, you know, that sort of situation. So they basically are going to believe anything they're told about, you know, what they have to do to survive. And, you know, they have to make it a good show. I mean, they've got these people set up, they've got a wall tent, they've got some food, they've got somebody camped out a few yards away with a gun in case a bear comes by. I mean, they have to make the drama out of something.
It's just, I mean, I can't even describe to you how, you know, what goes through my head at the prospect of this. And there you guys are. I mean, I think you would be in trouble if you didn't have butter. Maybe you might have a problem, for instance.
Well, yeah, the way we look at actually that, as far as that really simple level of kind of your fat, starch, protein ratios, is we protein's the one we don't worry about. You know, it's nice to have some protein in your diet, but what we really think about is the starch to fat ratio. We want to have enough starch to give us the energy to do stuff, but fat has much, much higher energy density, and what that translates to is a much lighter pack per calorie in it. And so we're always trying to kind of tune that ratio and have a diet that is as high in fat as possible. But there's a point where that breaks down, and we've had that happen. It's very unfortunate if you have too much fat in your diet and not enough starch, and then you try to do hard physical work, your body just kind of stops functioning. So that's what we're always thinking about. It's everything but the protein.
Well, our guests are Hig Higman and Aaron McKittrick of Ground Truth Trekking, who have a documentary out about one of their travels, Journey on the Wild Coast, and Barb Dubovich, CEO of Campfire USA Alaska Council. And Barb, you know, this, you're meeting these people for the first time. It's kind of an interesting couple. And wouldn't you say that this is kind of inspirational, what they're doing in to your mission?
Yeah, it's very exciting. Very exciting. And, you know, I love the fact that there's now a family doing this and young children being exposed to the outdoors very early on. You know, the earlier kids are exposed, the more comfort they have being out of doors, and the deeper the understanding of the natural world, the sooner they can have that exposure, the better. So it's very exciting. And I cannot imagine coming upon reality TV being filmed while you're out. It sounds surreal.
I think, however, and Hig or Aaron, you may want to chime in on this. I think almost any trek you do that, you know, goes beyond 10 miles or so, you're going to find something that, you know, that you learn from.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. You know, I bet you Barbara has some thoughts on this too, but we spent a lot of time out there and talked about like why is this something we want to do? Why is this important? You know, couldn't we maybe design a computer game that would achieve the same goals as going trekking? But and I think what it is it's exactly what you're talking about, Steve. It's not a built environment. It's not designed for you. It's completely open ended, and you have to respond to what reality, you know, what reality is, rather than having reality reportedly built for your, you know, for your comfort and convenience, and that's a really different experience than what I think we try to achieve with kind of our most, kind of the opposite of wilderness, if you think of your most built controlled civilized environment.
Yeah. Well, I think of the two of you as explorers of some kind of frontier that I can't even imagine. But I'm so glad you're at that frontier. But for our listeners, I also want to kind of bring it back to the everyday world that we're all living in which we've got two parents who have to go out and work. And Barb, don't the numbers already say that we don't even know how many youngsters in, say, the city of Anchorage are getting any kind of supervised care when they get out of school?
Right. There's a number, large number of youth that are going home alone after school. And so it's a great concern for not only working parents, but our community. And as Anchorage has shifted and changed, there's a fair amount of diversity in our city. And I think that folks don't yet realize that the income level, the moderate income, you know, the medium income level of families in Anchorage has shifted and changed. And there are more and more families that we will find in the lower income range. And so when they start to look at options for their children, whether it be before and after school or during the summer months, it becomes somewhat limited. And so we have a heavy push to make sure that all kids can have access, and particularly, we want to get kids who are really in our larger communities, inner cities, exposed to the out of doors. So we have both the day camp experience on the APU campus in the summer, but our resident camp on Kenai Lake, which is just, you know, one of the most gorgeous, beautiful wilderness spots in the state.
I couldn't even imagine when Debbie at Campfire got in touch with me and said, hey, you know, it's time for parents to start thinking about summer camp. I said, wait a minute. It's 2 degrees out there.
Well, now's the time. Now's the time to get registered.
I guess, you know, I'm a grandparent, and fortunately I don't have to be so day-to-day about this sort of stuff, but parents actually are starting to think now
for summer.
It's
absolutely
booking time.
It absolutely started March, just the first part of March. We started with registration. We have families that contact us right away in January because they start to plan their vacations for the year. Parents try to take time off. They want to know when camp dates are, when summer programs are going to be offered. You know, grandparents may be coming up to visit, and so there's just that coordinating and that scheduling. And kids today are a lot busier in terms of the kinds of things they're exposed to than you might find from your summer, Steve, or mine, in terms of what happens in their summer. So there's everything from the computer camp to the basketball camp to the summer sleepaway camp to maybe going outside and visiting relatives or having relatives come up. So kids are often, it could be in summer school, part of the summer. So there's just a wide variety of choices. But there's a section of kids that don't get access. And so, you know, listening to Aaron and Hig talk about, you know, Google Earth, one of our passions in Campfire is to get kids not only interested in Google Earth, but actually going out and finding out that once they're on the ground, it is different. And the experiences that happen for children when they're in the out of doors, they have to rely on one another. And in one of my concerns in the decades that I've been working with kids is that our electronic world and our communication has significantly changed. And our kids are growing up, and it's just natural and innate with them. But I'm concerned about their ability to communicate and to work with one another. And being out of doors and being in the natural world is just a conduit for that. And it's really fascinating for us to watch kids who come to resident camp. We tell them not to bring their cell phones, but they'll sneak them in occasionally. But they have very little, if no, service. And so then it becomes useless. And so it's amazing. There's like a switch that gets flipped. And it's like they forget that. And all of a sudden, they're talking to each other, and they're relating to each other, and they have to work together, and they have to do all their chores together, and they have to learn how to use the boat together, and they have to partner up, and they have to pack their packs together. And so there's a level of communication that happens that's just natural. And there's a security and a tightness that's formed. And for a lot of our kids, it's their first exposure. It's their first time actually outside the city. I can't tell you how many kids get on that bus here in Anchorage and make that 2-hour drive down the pass, and they think they're going to outer Siberia. I mean, it's just their first experience really being outside the city limits.
As you may have noticed, I opened the program talking about subsistence. And I know that you have a rural Alaska thrust in Campfire. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So back starting in the 60s, we started to begin to work in rural communities. And Alaska then and still today has the highest incident of youth drownings in our state.
Yes.
Obviously, the communities are built around cold, fast-moving water. And so kids are often exposed, and you won't go out and find, you know, a swimming pool there to learn how to swim in most of those communities. And so we started going out and doing water safety and teaching swimming, and we bring out life jackets. We work with the Kids Don't Float program and bring life jackets into the communities. We spend about 2 weeks in each of the communities, and we do not only the water safety, but a day camp type program for the kids. So for many of them, it's, you know, their summer event is Campfire coming out and doing everything from nature crafts and songs and drama and maybe some hikes, maybe some overnight camping in tents. We usually do a community family event in the village as well. So we bring the community together. And so we've been doing that since the 60s. And it's probably our least known program, but that happens every single summer.
It's probably the hardest one to fund.
It is. It can be a significant challenge. We don't charge participants to participate in the program. So the community has to find a venue to help pay for the cost of the program. And sometimes it's a school district. Sometimes it might be the co-op. It might be the Native Association. Sometimes there's funding found through the state. So each community is funded a little bit differently. But we charge only the cost to break even, you know, to cover our costs in getting our staff out and back.
Well, at this point, I'd like to bring it out to our listeners at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, statewide, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at APRN.org. We're back to this business of kids not getting outside enough. And it's a fact, and it's not just in the urban environments also. And one of the things that, you know, if I do nothing else that I want to do on this program today is underscore the importance of things like fish camp and subsistence activities, traditional things that the way many, many kids used to be brought up that are kind of fading away and not regarded with maybe the respect that they really could be accorded. Because you go back to this Ernest Thompson Seton, you know, it was 120 years ago, you know, resurrecting traditional skills that are still alive in our Alaska Native villages right now. And then you start thinking, you know, we need a lot more spirit camps. We need to pay every possible respect to subsistence and subsistence activities, because it's actually the solution for some of these problems. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If your organization is involved in some kind of spirit camp and you want to talk about that right now, that would be fine to call up and promote, because it is time for parents to start making those plans, as we've been discussing, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Pan Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at panair.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. What does an Athabascan artist, the teenage creator of a statewide energy campaign, and a National Geographic photographer have in common? A passion for Alaska and a Conservation Achievement Award from the Alaska Conservation Foundation. Nominate someone you know who's working to ensure a healthy Alaska for an ACF Conservation Achievement Award. Information available online at alaskaconservation.org. The deadline is March 31st. This message sponsored by the Alaska Conservation Foundation.
You It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about Campfire. We're talking about Journey on the Wild Coast, Ground Truth. And we're talking about The Last Child in the Woods. We've had the author of that book on here, and he made a very, very powerful case for the many benefits of engagement with the natural world and how we really have to start investing in making sure that young people in our culture get that exposure and get that exposure young. And that's something that Barb Dubovich of Campfire USA is nodding her head about, and I can totally understand that. We have a email, which is talk@APRN.org, from Mary in Ward Cove, Alaska, says, "Hey, I was just reading their current post for Ground Truth Trekking, and voila, there they are." So, Aaron and Hig, that's kind of a shout-out from Mary, who literally has been following you guys on your website, Ground Truth Trekking, right?
Well, yeah, groundtrekking.org, and any reasonable search, you'll probably come up with it one way or another. And we have a lot on there. We have stories about what we've done on there. We also have a lot of our research on different natural resource issues in Alaska, metals mining, coal mining, that sort of thing. And so there's a lot of information. You can spend a long time looking at photos and stuff on our site.
You have all these partners and friends and relations now. I mean, it's like, I couldn't believe it. I keep going down and there keep being more people involved with your operation.
Well, part of it is that just, you know, we've traveled through a lot of the state and, you know, people are just wonderful and generous everywhere you go. So pretty much any time we walk into a village or a town, we make a couple new friends. And over the years, that really starts to add up.
Yeah.
Wow. And so do I have the address, the website? Why don't you tell us what it is for those who don't know?
So it's groundtruthtrekking.org. And so trekking has two K's in it, T-R-E-K-K-I-N-G.
And are you planning, with your two kids now, what's the next trip you're thinking of?
The next trip is actually, the next big one is coming up this fall, and we're actually going to take our whole family out to Malaspina Glacier, which is down by Yakutat on the Lost Coast there, and spend 2 months traveling and exploring the area.
Yeah, we'll actually be in the same area where we ran into the reality TV show, but we want to live for a little while in this forested edge of the glacier. So there's forest growing on the ice. And you know, one of the things about, like, this is going back to the kids in the woods theme, you know, we have a backyard that's a wilderness right here, and just going and wandering around, there are so many things to learn and see, and this is a place of anywhere we've been, this is a place where things have been just seem the most complicated and interesting as far as that kind of small scale rooting around in the woods experience. So that's kind of part of what this inspiration is.
And it's also a place that with climate change is really rapidly changing the edge of the glacier there. And so that's one of the interesting things to explore.
So the Malaspina Glacier is for those who don't know, if you go in there on Google Earth, you can easily get lost on Malaspina Glacier because it's immense.
Yeah, 40 miles wide, forest growing along its edge. It's pushed right out up against the Pacific. There's a thin little moraine between it and the breaking waves, but that moraine is starting to go away now as the glacier melts. And when we were there in late 2007, there were forests calving into a lagoon there. It was brackish water, at least during big storms. And so that's a place it's changing really rapidly. We might actually, right now you go to Google Earth and what you see is this just vast area of low-lying ice, you know, ice that's down, not, you know, within a couple thousand feet of sea level. Within all our lifetimes, we may well, you know, just a few decades, we may well see a big bay opening up there, kind of like Icy Bay opened up in the last century here. And so there's a lot of really remarkable, sort of exciting geology to watch right there. And I'm a geologist, so this kind of gets me particularly excited.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, naming your child after LaToya Bay is a little bit of a clue there. that's kind of one of the most spectacular sites of, you know, tidal action and you know, monster tsunamis that wash thousands of feet up on the canyon walls and things like that.
Yeah, big earthquakes. And it's also just, you know, it's an amazing remote piece of wilderness. Just, you know, you can go from, you know, raw glacially sculpted gravels to ancient forests in just a few miles and old muskegs in that area. It's a remarkable place with a long human history, too. Although no one lives there now, there's both historic there was a person who lived on Cenotaph Island there for many years, and there were native communities there going back who knows how long.
Let's go to the telephone. Sandra joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sandra.
Hi, Steve. I want to thank you for doing this program. I think it's great to combine the real adventure trekking with the bringing it home to the need for to getting kids outdoors. My main question, though, I saw the documentary that Hig and Aaron did, and I've read Aaron's book, which, by the way, I want to give a shout-out about. It's wonderful. It is so poetically written and evocative. It's just great. But I wanted to find out if the documentary is available on DVD.
Go ahead.
The quick answer is that it will be, but it's not yet. We're because the film festivals are really they want to be showing a movie that you can't order online yet. We've out of respect for that, we haven't released it yet, and I don't have an exact date for you. But if you go on our site, you can sign up for a reminder as soon as it's available.
Okay.
Yeah, and I wanted to. Thank you for the kind words about my book. And for those who don't know, the name of that is A Long Trek Home. Anybody?
I was trying to remember. I didn't want to say it wrong, but it really is a great book, and I recommend it to all people who love the out of doors. You'll just be engrossed by it. Thank you very much.
Bye. And that name is Aaron McKittrick, McKittrick. CK. All right, Sandra, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Robin, joins the program from Houston, Alaska. Robin, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, my question was for the person that was on for Campfire.
Barbara's sitting right here.
Yeah, I actually was a counselor for Camp Cushtaka about 15 years ago, and I really loved it, and I think it's a great, I think Campfire is just a great program. And now I have children of my own, and my husband's a teacher, and we have summers off, and we thought it would be a really good opportunity to go and be camp directors or camp leaders as a family. I was wondering if there is any opportunities for families to do that.
Go ahead, Barb Dubich.
Yeah, well, thank you. Good to hear from you. And yes, there are. I believe, you know, talking about this season, I think we've already hired staff, and so we're good to go. But what I would encourage you to do is to get online on our webpage. It's campfireak.org. You'll okay. find my contact information on there. So feel free to contact me directly. You'll get my email off there. And I will connect you up with our camp folks so that in future years we can maybe make that connection. And I'd welcome you if you're in town. You know, you're always welcome to stop by our main office. We're in Mountain View now, 161 Clevin Street. So please feel free to do either of those things. My direct contact phone line is 257-8806. And so would love to make those connections, especially with past counselors that have experience with us. A few years back, we had a nurse that brought her children, and so they spent the summer down at camp and were able to participate in the different activities with different groups of kids as well. So it's something that's possible.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, great.
All right, Robin, thanks for your call, 1-800-478-8255. Still looking for those calls for people that are busy trying to get a spirit camp oriented. It's difficult. There's a lot of logistics, but I know there's at least half a dozen going on or planned this summer around the state, and we'd be happy to help promote those because I think traditional activities is a really important part of getting kids engaged with the natural world. Getting Kids Outside is the theme on Talk of Alaska. The telephone number 1-800-478-8255. If calling from Anchorage, it's 550-8422, and email is talk@aprn.org. Yeah, I was in the Boy Scouts. I was a senior patrol leader even, and I went to scout camp, and it was a profound experience for me, even though I'm one of those kids that was in the woods all the time, to have to deal with the kind of challenges that the structure of the camp requires of you. You know, you're going to deal with sharp objects, you know, you're going to deal with water, you're going to deal with walking a long distance. 5 miles seemed like a long distance then, and so forth.
Fire.
Yeah. Just learning all those things totally stayed with me for the rest of my life. I mean, made a different person out of me right away. I mean, first tenderfoot trying to start a fire, and you actually need to start the fire.
You really need to start the fire if you're going to have lunch. Yeah. Yeah, it's a big difference. And it's fascinating to watch youth who might come to camp and pick up a bow and arrow for the very first time, and how they, you know, are somewhat afraid of it, really, in the very beginning. And by the end of the week, you know, they feel like they're mastering that particular skill. And it's those experiences.
I think we're scared of just about everything to start out with.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think that's kind of the way the world works. And when you watch the documentary, Journey on the Wild Coast, that's the first thing that you, I think, hits you pretty hard when, you know, Hig and Aaron, just to brag you up a little bit, when you don't give up, when you can't get across the bay full of icebergs, that's inspirational. And then by the time you get all the way out to False Pass, you're to the point where it doesn't even matter to you that, I mean, well, I won't say it doesn't matter. Obviously it matters, but even though your food is destroyed, your shelter is destroyed, a bear has basically just ripped everything up, and you're going to complete your trek. Even so, you're going to sew things up somehow and keep going. And I think a person that didn't have some experience in this sort of improvisatory trekking would simply say, well, that's it. I simply can't do it. When actually it's still in them to do it. You know, and I my hat's off to you guys. And I thought maybe you might have some comments about finding your inner resources, which was the real reason I wanted to have you on this program.
Yeah, and actually that's something that, you know, I think that, you know, when you spend a lot of time in the outdoors, and this is true obviously for kids and adults, that's the kind of thing you learn, because it's not a scripted environment. It's not a sculpted environment. You don't know what's going to happen, and you just have to look at what's around you and make it work. And, you know, starting, the more time you spend out there, the more time you realize that you can make it work, that, you know, you can use some skills, use mostly some common sense, and just, you know, think about what you need to do and make it happen. And I think it's a really powerful lesson that people can learn out there.
Yeah, I think a really common sort of, like in the Boy Scouts, a lot of these youth outdoor experience camp, that kind of thing, the common exercise is I refer to it as just the long night. The idea is you go out and you build a little shelter and you stay in it overnight. And it sounds initially like the lesson to learn is about, okay, well, so how should you build your shelter? And what do you do to, you know, make yourself more comfortable? But I think the biggest lesson I learned when I did that as an exercise, actually we had a project adventure class that was part of high school. The biggest thing I learned is just that eventually the night does end, you wake up all the time because you're cold and stuff, because you don't know how to build a shelter, and really it's not easy. But the important thing is that if you just keep going, you get through it. So that's kind of that's your baseline. And with a little learning, you can do a lot better than that. And you know, hey, if you're so lucky as to have a tent that's been torn up by a bear and maybe even some sewing supplies and a fire going, well, then, you know, then you're looking at a right lavish night, you know.
Right lavish. That's another thing that occurs to me, is it gets to be relative. it gets to be that a candy bar, for instance, has an entirely different value than it would when you're standing next to a convenience store.
Definitely. Instead of being the thing that, you know, you probably should try to avoid eating, it's, you know, a precious piece of calories that you need to keep yourself going.
Not only that, but it's going to taste a whole lot better.
Definitely. Yeah, I actually don't like candy bars at all at home.
Barb Dubovich, to what degree does Campfire go into this business of actually outdoor, I don't know what to say, woodcraft skills and things like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, you brought the swimming thing, which is, I think, is really important. You can understand why Alaska's in the situation on swimming that it is. Mm-hmm. If you just look at, why would anybody jump in the water? It's cold.
It's cold.
You don't do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, once float coats were invented, you would think people would use them, but no.
Yeah. Well, we the kids swim in Kenai Lake, which we claim is one of the coldest lakes in the state.
That's true.
It's glacier fed.
I ground truth that one.
Yeah, it's quite cold. When visitors come down, you know, we dare them to at least put their feet in while the kids are out there swimming. And so the kids do swimming then, cold water. So there's a lot of cold water safety that we work with the kids on. They do both canoeing, some kayaking. So they get out on the water, both in our day camp and our resident camp. For many, it's the first time in a boat on the water.
So this means that first off, they're going to be well supervised. And second off, they're going to learn some things about how you get in and out of and balance and what a paddle does and doesn't do and so forth.
Right.
What the wind does.
Yeah, and then there's a natural progression. So depending on the age of the kids and how much exposure they've had to the out of doors, you know, there's a natural progression. You may have kids out leading, you know, being, you know, at the front of the canoes, you know, and everybody, you know, spots that canoe and follows that canoe.
And it's all done co-ed?
It's all done co-ed.
How do you work that?
Well, we have cabins, you know, that are not co-ed. We
you
have
got the boys' cabins and the girls' cabins.
Yeah, that's
still,
exactly right. Yeah. And so,
and you got counselors and
yeah, there's
sort of
male,
thing.
Female counselors. So there's a good mixture. We also bring in international staff, so we have an opportunity just to expose kids to different cultures and languages, folks that might be different than themselves, and just get that broader exposure. So it's a wide variety. We're rebuilding the camp, actually, and so we're in the middle of a capital development, and that development will include actually putting in a low ropes course and a climbing wall eventually, so kids will have exposure to those kinds of higher risk activities in a controlled way so that they can learn.
So this is your camp on Kenai?
Right, and we now call it Camp K. You know, Robin called it Camp Kristaka, and so the name is changing and moving, and it's now
when I was at the Ernest Thompson Seton era, you know, everything had to have some kind of weird fake Indian name.
Yeah, yeah, and so we're letting go of that and moving on. And so, the new camp also will serve more kids, and so we're looking forward to extending our season. It won't be winterized, and that's a hope and a dream down the road, but we will at least be able to build our shoulder seasons.
So do you get booked up?
We do. And so, again, I'd encourage the families that are listening to get online and get registered and or call. In April, there's a publication comes out by the Daily News that talks about a lot of the camps, but oftentimes parents find if they wait that long, even camps get filled up. So,
okay, you heard it first here. 1-800-478-8255. Local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@APRN.org. We have Barb Dubovich of Campfire USA Alaska Council as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Indian Trust Land IIM account Indian Trust account aging you mountain 3.4 billion dollar settlement. Agochtor Yugovit Alamak settlement dam kang narotinik, Bunakochivnik Kranacht Darvikun. Website amun IndianTrust.com amun BU Mountain, Hwaltoklorlugu 1-800-961-6109.
Well, parents, if you didn't have the pad out already and the pencil, get it out now. This one comes from Steve Levy, by email from Fairbanks. Hi, John Mente and Boreal House run Week in the Woods every summer outside of Fairbanks. This program is multi-age, immerses students, campers, in a boreal forest with a troop of the North's finest craftspeople, artists, and naturalists.
Nice.
Here, students learn about the boreal forest and how to use the resources in traditional and artistic manners. It is a magical and brilliant program completely separate from the techno world. Go to weekinthewoods.org to get filled in. Thank you very much, Steve. And let's see, we got this one from Dennis Stevens of the Alaska Center for Horace Kephart Studies in Fairbanks. Yes, Horace Kephart. Oh, you never heard of him? Well, just listen. Thanks for this program on this important theme. It's surely a serious matter that kids are no longer spending time outside playing in the woods. Another very popular writing on camping and woodcraft, a contemporary of Ernest Seton Thompson, was Horace Kephart, who, like Thompson, served on the board of Boy Scouts. Kephart's wonderful book, Camping and Woodcraft, first published in 1906, that's before Boy Scouts was founded, Boy Scouts of America, has never been out of print. He praised the virtues of basking and sporting in the great, clean outdoors and the spiritual refreshment for kids and adults of getting out of the crowded, grimy cities and into the green fields and far rolling hills. Thank you so much, Dennis. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about getting kids outside. We've got Hig Higman and Aaron McKittrick of Ground Truth Trekking, who are featured in the documentary Journey on the Wild Coast. I have to bring up one more anecdote out of this documentary, which sticks with me, and that is the business of knives that are not all they could be and still going on even so.
Of knives?
Yeah. You guys suffered some degeneration of your tools and just kept going, I guess is my point.
At one point, well, you know, of all sorts of tools. And you know, I think it really fits in kind of what you were talking about earlier, that, you know, it's working with what you've got there. And you know, suddenly or like maybe our ice axe, for instance, we had an ice axe that was broken in half, and you know, it's still an incredibly valuable tool if you don't have anything else. And we also it's really hard when you're getting up and moving every day. You know, we're moving our whole life, and we're not the most organized people on the planet. And so there were a number of things that got left behind, including both knives. I think at one point both of us.
The first snowstorm of the trip, we hadn't quite gotten our system to not lose things in the snow. And, you know, like a lot of things, I think that you just have to, you know, look at what you have and how well it works and just figure out a way to make do. I mean, when you're actually out in the middle of nowhere and there's no one else there, it kind of forces you to be resourceful in a way that we all could be if we had to.
I'm hearing lounge music. Where's it coming from?
Not us.
Okay. Whatever. We're out in the middle of the woods. Suddenly, it's Kenny G. This one from on email, Nusunginya, says fish camps are in decline because people are forced to deal with cash economy, can no longer take the 2 months necessary to dry the fish, traditionally made into dry fish, and those who make extra to sell to those who cannot physically make their own, or because they have jobs they can't leave, can't take the time off to go to fish camp, are currently being treated like criminals by the state and federal government for selling fish to make expenses. A senior living in the city because of health reasons, subsisting on Social Security, can't go to fish camp and make dry fish, but they can spare the $20 to buy a half pound of fish from someone who is maintaining a camp. The fish is a vital source of vitamin D in winter, and selling it to each other, which has always been done, has been made into illegal activity. One recent complaint on the federal level was that over $1,000 was made by some individuals selling dry fish. They don't take into account the gas costs money, as does a boat, a motor, a net, grub, et cetera, et cetera. People who could not themselves maintain a camp in the summer have always bought from those who can, and make the activity illegal only serves to deprive those who can't fish from having their traditional food, which is vital to their health. Well, I think that's another show. I think that's another show, but I appreciate the email. And it is true that there is less happening in fish camp than there once was. And the point, I think, in the show that we're having today is kids and going outside. Hig and Aaron, how are you going to handle bringing up your two kids? I mean, obviously they're coming along with you, so they're going to get that part. But when it comes time, you know, you're legally required to give them an education. Are you going the homeschooling route, or what are you going to do?
Well, we have, it's sort of interesting in a town like Soldovia, because it's a relatively small town, and so the school is, you know, kind of needs all the kids it can get. So I think that, you know, assuming that it's a good place for them, we probably will send our kids to the school here with their friends. That's not to say that we won't feel like we can pick up and homeschool them for a while if we want to take off on an adventure.
Yeah, I mean, there seems like you could do a lot of amazing things with just, if you're open to the idea of taking the kids out of school for a couple months to go wander in the woods and do that kind of school. So, but there's
I think it's a whole curriculum out there, you guys.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
I really think it is. I mean, it just needs to be structured. I know some have tried. I think Chugach School District has some of, you know, taking traditional activities, and it's kind of a coming thing. Barb Dubovich of Campfire USA Alaska Council, we only got like a minute left, but I wanted to ask you, you have some after-school stuff too, right?
We do. We have before and after-school programs in about 30 schools here in the Anchorage School District, and so we serve about 1,200 kids a day.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. www.campfire.org.
CampfireAK.org.
And Hig and Aaron, thanks for cooperating with our first Skype experiment.
Well, I look great. Welcome to the 21st century.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. Seems to work fine.
Yeah, it does. Well, we're at the concluding. The concluding 1 minute of the show. Barb, you got anything you want to add?
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to meet Aaron and Hig and hear about them. I wish them well. And thank you, Steve, for the opportunity. Get our kids out.
Yeah, I'm wondering if maybe, you know, they might be able to do some kind of campfire presentation even, maybe.
Yeah, I think the kids would love to hear about this. And so
you guys,
I've written down their website, so I have it. So thank you.
And once again, that is...
Drop us an email.
Yeah, drop us an email. And I'll say that, you know, the things we do now might sound, you know, kind of amazing and way out there, but I grew up in Seattle, and I went to, you know, summer camp, and, you know, that was some of my first...
All right. We're out of time.
...experience in the outdoors.
Thanks a lot. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by... ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.